Hello, my fellow listeners. Thank you so much for tuning in. I can't tell you how amazing you people are for tuning in week after week. It's very, very humbling, and I'm hoping to continue to do my job for you and bring forth as many critical thinkers to you in the automotive and mobility space. Today's episode is a rather unique one, but when you get an opportunity to sit down and talk with a brilliant data scientist, you find a way to make it work. And so a few months ago, I attended a conference, and at this conference, not only was I an attendee, but I was also a featured host. This was the Automotive CX Summit in Marina Del Rey, California. There were lots of great thought leaders in the automotive space from either from the vendor side, from automakers, even to some of the few dealers that were there. There were even guests from the show, from Wisco Weekly, like Brian Allen from Hire Car and Chuck Schofield from Auto Gravity in attendance here. And as a side note, there will actually be a future episode of Auto Gravity coming up too. So stay tuned for that one. But one of the featured speakers at this conference was also a professionally educated data scientist. And so I knew from the outset that if I could meet him and especially interview him, then I would make that all happen. And by the generosity of one of the organizers of the event, Mrs. Pam Walters, she introduced me to him. And so he agreed, and here is that episode. And while at the start, I butchered his last name, which is totally disrespectful and unacceptable in my eyes, he did forgive me, and we moved on. And hopefully you will get the insight into knowing about how a data scientist thinks about things, how a data scientist thinks about automotive marketing. My guest serves as the Intelligent Customer Interaction Strategy Manager at Ford Motor Company, and he previously worked at information service companies like Axiom and Polk, which is now IHS Market. Coincidentally, IHS Market owns another company who has been featured on the show before, and that is Automotive Mastermind. My guest received his undergraduate degree in computer science and technology at the University of Michigan, and he received his MBA from Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. So listeners, please enjoy this conversation to get to know the mind and body of Mr. Michael Spadafore.
You are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Welcome to Wisco Weekly. I'm here with Mike Spadafore.
Spadafore.
I apologize. Mm-hmm. Mike Spadafore. Mm-hmm. And Mike is new to the podcasting game. This is his first podcast ever. I feel very, very honored to have you on, Mike. Mike is, you know, in short, I will just say he's a data scientist. That's definitely not going to encapsulate everything that he is and everything that he does, because certainly as I just sat through his session, his mind is something to be saved for later generations. If anything, we may want to replicate AI based off his mind alone. So Mike, maybe let's talk about you, sir. You're originally from Detroit.
Yes.
Michigan area.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How did you get started in the data science game?
Well, coming out of school, at the University of Michigan, I studied computer science and psychology because that was, you know, where artificial intelligence was going at that time, way, way back when. And I got my first job at a company called Market Opinion Research, which was a big Republican polling house, doing analysis of data for elections and that kind of thing. And so started, you know, right from the beginning, studying people's behavior and how they reacted and polling and the statistical analysis associated with that, and really moved into like product development, but products that had to do with big data, which back then was much smaller amount of data than we're talking now, but for that time. And I actually started my own business, a political consulting business around data and that kind of thing. And put together what was really the first PC-based parallel processing network in order to be able to process what, again, then was large amounts of data using
And what were you like? What was the data sets you were processing at that point?
Voter files, and then demographic data and that kind of stuff to try to identify people that were likely to, you know, be in support of particular campaigns and candidates and things like that.
At some point, you jumped at Polk.
Yes.
After that.
Yep. So I worked in the political business for a while. Then it became clear that in order to stay in that business, I really needed to move to D.C. and I didn't want to do that. All my clients were at the national level, and I wanted to stay in Detroit, and my family was there and all of that. So Polk was one of the companies based in Detroit that was really into data. At that time, they were both automotive and non-automotive, and so I got involved at Polk.
Give me the context of the year right now.
That was 1996,
okay.
I believe, yeah.
And mm-hmm. After Polk?
I worked at Polk for a couple of years, and then from there, actually I went back and got my MBA and did some consulting.
At Kellogg?
Yep, mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, in Northwestern. And then I went back to Polk and got heavily involved in product development and analytics-based products and digital marketing type stuff, and was there for about 10 more years.
What was the status of Polk at that time, given that data was, it wasn't in its infancy stages, but it certainly was just, there was just a lot coming at you guys, were you guys modeling data at that point already?
We were for sure modeling data. Polk kind of led the way in, there was a law that was passed called DPPA, Driver's Privacy Protection Act, which made it so that people would have to actually opt in on their DMV data in order for it to be used for marketing, which essentially stopped the availability of that data. Nobody opted in. Mm. And so at that point, Polk and really the entire automotive industry, because they were all kind of following Polk relative to analytics at that time, had to really increase the amount of analytics they used, because the raw data was no longer available. I could no longer use the fact that you registered a vehicle 6 months ago to market to you for that. I couldn't use it for marketing anymore, so we had to start modeling. And so that really is what created the significant uptick in predictive analytics in the automotive space, was that event.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm hearing about more and more at this Thought Leadership Summit conference is just the garage data, which this kind mm-hmm. of then goes back to, you know,
that is DPP. That kind of data, yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, let's pivot a little bit then. Garage data, is there a future for the possibility of that data to be beholden to the automotive ecosystem?
Well, it's still a big part of the automotive ecosystem. It's just now, since 2000, when the Driver's Privacy Protection Act passed, you can't use it for marketing directly. You can use it for analytics, and you can use it for statistical analysis, like counting and that kind of stuff. But you couldn't use it to market to people anymore. There really is no better way to collect that specific data, meaning the DMV data.
Right.
What Polk and Experian collect is title and registration information. Mm-hmm. They buy it from the states.
Mm-hmm.
That's a key component of like predictive analytics in the automotive space, but now there's a lot more data from other sources to collect that will have more impact probably than that garage level data.
Such as?
Like behavioral data, so like what consumers actually do now on the web, so clickstream data, digital exhaust, if you will, information that gives an indication of what that consumer was doing and therefore gives some indication of where they may be in that repurchase journey or that kind of thing, right?
Do you have any thoughts about the modeling of combining that data?
Yeah, I mean, the ideal thing is to, we call it slow and fast data. So the slow data is like the garage data that says, you know, what vehicles do you have in your garage? What vehicles do you own? The current vehicle that you own is a very strong predictor for the vehicle you're likely to buy. So that's the slow data. Along with that is like demographic data. What's your estimated household income? What's your length of address? You know, how long you've lived where you are, presence of children, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the slow data. And it's best to combine that with fast data, which is, you know, what websites have you recently visited? Have you called into the call center? Did you generate an online lead? Both tier 1 and tier 3 data. So the information that you generate interacting with the dealer and the information you generate interacting with the OEM.
I mean, I guess before we start talking about maybe, you know, I'd almost like to hear you rate, you know, where the modeling state is right now. And perhaps that might even be a criticism of your own work as well. But I don't know, I guess we'll figure that out. You know, what flaws are you do you see right now with the data that's available?
Well, it's traditionally incomplete, right? So there's lots of missing data. So we might know, you know, how long you've been at your address, but we might not know if you filed bankruptcy within the past 5 years. We may have a piece of information that says you went to an automotive website, but we may not know that actually it was like AutoZone to do some DIY repair as opposed to, you know, an OEM's website to shop for a new car. So the data itself is, you know, messy and in many cases incomplete and sporadic, right? So sometimes we know about you and sometimes we don't. And that the industry likes to talk about knowing the customer and where they are in the journey. The reality is that we see the customer reappear here and there and now and then on the journey. There's just a very much an element of kind of going on the dark side of the moon for a while, then coming back in, and
but you
that
know,
kind of thing.
You know, I think one of the things that if I understood your presentation correctly, there's almost you don't even really see that customer journey at all, right? You see more. I mean, obviously you're a data scientist guy, so you see the data in all of that. But do you also understand where they are in that customer journey too?
Some of the data is pretty indicative of where they are on the journey.
Okay.
And some of the data, you can know like what place they're in on that journey, but you don't really know the timing associated with it, right? So like some customers, when they know they need to buy a new vehicle, say their lease is going to be up, they're excited about it. They start 3 months ahead researching and that kind of thing. Other customers will wait till the last 5 days, walk into the dealership, go, I want another one like that, change the color. I'm done. So it's kind of like everybody goes through the same stages, but it's difficult to be able to tell, you know, if somebody's, you know, moving through it slowly, moving through it quickly, you know, that kind of thing.
You know, like all the data talk that we're talking about here. I mean, obviously at some point you were collecting this data, you're modeling it, predicting it, and then handing it off to the side of the operation that's supposed to do something with it.
Right.
And obviously they're going to try to do what's, you know, they'll try to get the most value.
Yep.
Is there a particular aspect of an automotive operation that they are not capitalizing on because perhaps they are misinterpreting the data, in your opinion?
It's partly because they may be misinterpreting it and partly because they're just not leveraging the information well. I mean, the analytics is critically important, but being able to operationalize the analytics is actually the most important thing, right? So you can spend a lot of time getting your model to perform, you know, 3% better, right? You can bring in more interesting data, do more sophisticated analytics and mathematics, and the model will improve a bit. But the reality is what's more important is that you get the outcome from that model, the scored data, available to the marketers so that they use it properly in campaigns. That's actually the harder, more challenging part than improving the model a bit.
So somebody has the data, a marketer has the data, they're going to do something with it. Are you know, the way you view it, are you just hands-off at that point?
No. You want as tight a interaction between the analytics activity and the marketing strategy and the marketing operations.
Okay.
Those three things, right? So there's a team that's working on the strategy saying, here's the customers we're trying to go after. Here's the type of marketing we want to do based upon the product and the business objectives. And then you've got the team that actually does the analytics to try to achieve that. But then you have to operationalize that inside what I would call marketing operations, where the marketing technology is put in place and the campaigning is done and that kind of thing.
And, you know, so one of the big things as we look at, you know, this whole customer journey is, you know, just being able to target a Mike Spadafore, a Dennis Wisco.
Yep.
You know, what concepts do you apply in order to create a Dennis Wisco profile? Or how would you create a Dennis Wisco profile?
Well, you can use the data, right? And so we would call it segmentation, right? And there would be segmentation that would, you know, the segmentation initially is fairly coarse. And there may be Dennis Wiskos and Mike Spadafores and all kinds of people inside that, because the data you're relying on is not very detailed or very recent. It's pretty slow data. So when you use the analytics, it can only partition it to a certain level, which is still useful, right? You can maybe cater messages to those individual segments or different type of channels, that kind of thing. But you want to get those segments to be smaller and smaller and more fine-grained until finally you're actually really targeting the individual themselves. That's the best thing.
No, in that example that you're drawing, though, and you know, you want to get it smaller and smaller, obviously you want to start with a huge data set, though.
You want to start it with a huge data set, but you want to slice it very finely, right? If you start with a huge data set and you say all the people who like blue cars are on one side and red cars are on the other, okay, that's helpful, but it's not as helpful as being able to say all the people who are very concerned about the cost of the vehicle, total operation costs, and the fact that it seats five, go over here. Then people who want something that seats seven, go over here. The finer you can break it up, the better, and that kind of thing.
And that data is available, you're saying?
It is available.
Maybe not explicitly, but you know, through internet activity, essentially? Is that how you would look
through internet activity and through, you know, again, that demographic data and the transactional data that's associated with previous interactions the brand has had with those individuals? You can put it together. People wouldn't be able to see those relationships, but the analytics can, right? So that's the whole idea, is you take a population that exhibited the behavior that you want to model previously. So people who bought a Ford Escape. You take that population, then you take all the data you know about other people and you mix it together and use the advanced analytics to help you identify more people that look like those Ford Escape buyers, and then that's who you market to.
And you know what you're sharing with me too. If I don't think it's a far stretch to say. I mean, these aren't trade secrets that you're sharing.
No, not at all. No.
And so then, like, where do you see the most opportunity right now with the, you know, with data scientists and their ability to model and present the data?
I think the most opportunity lies in the ability to be able to analyze, to be able to sense and respond to the consumer, right? So to be able to analyze data that the consumer leaves as they interact with the OEM or the large dealer group's marketing ecosystem. So did they open the email? What did the email say? Did they go to the website? What did they do when they were there? By stringing that data along with the demographic and transactional data we know about them, you can make decisions about what the next best thing to communicate to that consumer is. Mm-hmm. And that's really where the opportunity is. It's less about creating desktop models that you then use to create a population that you send a message to, and more about creating an analytics system that will sense what people are doing and ideally in real time react right back to them.
Now, it does this kind of refer back to what you had mentioned on your session about, like, the plumbing?
Yes, yep, absolutely, yeah. In order to do that kind of sophisticated, like, always-on, real-time engine, you need to connect all those places where you can sense what the consumer's doing. Mm-hmm. So your websites, all the communications you proactively send out, like emails and all of that, you need to connect that back into the front end of the system where you're deciding what to do next. Mm-hmm. So like the decisioning engine and the targeting engine that decides who to send what to next.
Well, to that point too, you actually brought up something I thought was interesting, and that was the business models, mm-hmm. and how automakers and the automotive industry as a whole, you know, like an owner, a CEO would see what Netflix is doing, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, like, they pick up on the buzzwords, and then all of a sudden it's a directive,
right?
But your contention is that these automakers, or at least in the automotive space, these are not tech companies. Can you elaborate more
right.
on that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, like if you take a company like Amazon, so Amazon was, well, initially it was born as a bookstore, right? I mean, it was an online bookstore, but you know, it was born out of data analytics. I mean, that was just how they did their business from the beginning, before it was even fashionable, before there was even the concept of big data or the concept of, you know, advanced data analytics and all of that kind of thing. That business was born out of, you know, assessing how things were performing and then using that to continually improve distribution networks and that kind of thing to get them to where they are today. You compare that to like an automotive company, which was born out of essentially the Industrial Revolution, right? I mean, you know, and the assembly line and what 100 years ago were amazing developments, but 100 years ago, right? So there's that, you know, Ford and GM and even Toyota and all those companies have been operating for literally, you know, half a century, without ever even being really horribly concerned about the concept of data analytics. I mean, you know, they certainly use data and that kind of thing, but not like we talk about now. So there's a completely different type of DNA involved. And the automotives are making great strides to, you know, kind of try to get there, right, with their mobility efforts and all of those kinds of things. But it's, you know, they have a lot of work to do yet around that. And the business model is very, very different, right? I mean, data analytics likes high-frequency, small transactions, not low-frequency, big transactions. Mm-hmm. Well, automotive is in the latter bucket. Mm-hmm. So it's not as conducive to highly responsive kind of marketing. We have to be, in effect, it's harder for us. We have to be more clever than, say, Netflix. For Netflix to create a recommendation engine is very easy, right? I mean, 10 million people or whatever the number is log on every night and tell them what they like and what they don't. Pretty easy to create sophisticated analytics when you have that much data. That's not the case for OEMs.
And so in that instance, mm-hmm. I'm almost led to believe through your eyes that there's not to say that the automakers as a whole are you know, hopeless.
No, and it's not hopeless at all. It's just we're on a different timetable, right? I mean, again, you know, Netflix, Amazon, Google, when they were first created, this was just second nature to them. It's like me being involved in computers or you being involved in computers or my 22-year-old son. Mm-hmm. To him, it's natural. There's no thought of, I have to go somewhere to buy something. It's, I've got to go online and see where it's available. Completely different perspective. So there's that. And the other thing is there are, the automotives do have some things that are going to kind of change their business model, but in particular connected vehicle data, right? So those many millions of vehicles that are out there are going to now start throwing off a lot of data that kind of gets it into the same scope of data that like a high frequency, high transaction thing like Netflix or Google or whatever might have.
Well, so actually, I'm glad you brought this up because, you know, one of the things that we often talk about on the show is just, you know, we start to get into things like vehicle miles traveled and congestion mm-hmm. pricing. Are you familiar with those?
Not congestion pricing, but
vehicle miles traveled?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, I for one am a proponent of connected cars. I think as you start to get to, you know, as you have connected cars, you have V2V, V2I. Can I put you as a governor and say, look, in the state of Michigan, you know, here's Mike, Governor Mike, that is going to help fund the connected cars mm-hmm. and help fund infrastructure. What kind of data and modeling would you start to look at?
So it's funny that you bring up Michigan because Michigan's actually we have lots of problems with our roads, right? They're known to be not in good shape, and part of that is Michigan has like almost zero toll roads, none, okay. Right? Whereas like the rest of the Midwest, which has the same problems with freezing and all of that, and the roads go terribly every year, they have toll roads that pay for the maintenance of those roads yep. and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I'm not very familiar with. The, you know, the many issues that surround how to fund those kinds of things. I am familiar with the fact that, to your point, that the fact that you can have connected vehicles that are connected to each other and that are throwing off all kinds of information will facilitate a more balanced model of how to at least associate usage with wear. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, because that's really what you're talking about. If I got a truck that's destroying the roads, I should pay more than if I've got a Prius out there yep. doing whatever. The data will enable that. Mm-hmm. How you actually get through the legal mumbo jumbo and the political mumbo jumbo of what pays for what or whatever, I'm not. That's
what do you mean? You worked in the political campaigns.
That was many years ago in a different life. Yeah, no. Mm-mm.
Yep. Well, Mike, are you active on social media at all, or do you write? Do you
no.
like personally? Actually, do you? Yeah. What are you doing personally?
Well, I'm an empty nester now. Both my boys are out of the home, okay. That kind of thing. So my wife and I work and travel and, trying to get used to the quieter, slower life that is there. I don't blog or not a big social network or whatever.
I enjoy. Any books? Do you have a patent in the works? Anything?
No patents. Books, reading some good books.
What are some books you're reading right now?
The Model Thinker, that's one. I just finished Dorian Gray. I'm like on this classics thing where I'm reading this whole list of books you're supposed to read before you die or something like that. So
hold on, wait, what?
No, it's just you can. there's like,
I'm glad we're doing this recording then. Only evidence of Mike's
metaphor. No. There's the top 50 books you should read kind of thing or whatever. And so, Dorian Gray, War and Peace, Frankenstein, all these classics.
If knowing what you just went through right now with mm-hmm. me asking you these questions, what books would you recommend for someone like myself to read to more understand either the trends or the nuances of data?
There's a book called Marketing and Predictive Analytics. I have to check who the author is. It's part of a development course that I've put together for everyone that's on my team, all the product owners, so that they can get a generalized understanding of marketing and analytics. Doesn't require you to be a data scientist, but it touches on data science issues, and it gives you a good understanding of one-to-one marketing and digital marketing. Mm-hmm. A couple other books that they are asked to read are around product development and that kind of thing. If you really want to understand what's going on in AI right now, I don't even know if I'd recommend a book. I'd recommend just go online and start to read some of the papers, because there are so many papers being generated so fast in this field.
Where are they
right
coming
now.
Out? Like academic papers,
Yeah, academic papers, white papers written by businesses, white papers that are written by companies that are selling AI services. And I know that they have like a commercial bent to them and that kind of thing.
Sure,
but
sure.
But it's happening so fast that, unless you're reading the book that was published yesterday, you ought to be reading.
Who do you follow, or who would be like the individuals that you're like, when it comes to predictive analytics, mm-hmm. this is the guy, this is the professor that I turn to?
I don't, relative to predictive analytics, not really anyone. I mean, because it's pretty general. I'm a big fan of the Santa Fe Institute, which is an institute that is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, focuses on like complexity theory and agent-based theory and evolutionary algorithms and just very kind of forward stuff. When I went to school, I studied under a guy named John Holland. He's passed away now, but he was a genius, a MacArthur genius and all mm-hmm. this kind of stuff, and was the father of genetic algorithms and so on. Mm-hmm. He started that institute and lots of smart people there. So. Mm. Yeah,
I will. I'm definitely gonna look into that. Yeah. Hell, I might pay a little visit over there.
It's a very cool place.
Is it part of the University of New Mexico then, or is it a standalone?
Nope, it's just a standalone institute. Has lots of visiting professors because complexity theory is very multidisciplinary. So you get lots of different people coming in from the biological sciences, philosophy, artificial intelligence, computer science. All that different stuff mixed together.
I don't want to embarrass you, but have you been invited?
No. It's a pretty hardcore academic environment.
Sure.
So it's more, you need to be like a professor at University of Chicago or Michigan or Stanford.
Well,
or
I would certainly
like
though think that it, you possess a certain amount of insight that they don't have access to. But I guess
they're pretty fundamental science kind of, uh-huh. right? I mean. They have, it's not that it's not real world applicable, but they're studying very basic problems, so probably my stuff is more applied.
Okay.
So.
Well, Mike, Thank you, sir.
No, it's been wonderful. Thank you
for being on. I appreciate it. This is, I think this is one of those episodes. I don't often listen to my own episodes because I hate the sound of my voice, but I think this is one of those things I have to turn back to because I think there's just a lot of things that I'm going to have to write back down so I can look into it. So thank you very much
for your
time. No,
my pleasure. I appreciate it. Okay. Thank you.
Listeners, be sure you check out the episode page. I'll put some more information on Mike Spatafor. Mike, can people follow you on
LinkedIn?
LinkedIn?
That's what I participate the most. Yeah.
So I'll put his information on LinkedIn so you can connect with Mike. As we end every episode, cheers, prost, l'chaim, kipis, nastravi, salut, kampai, mabruk, tutsins, gambe, yamas, nastarovie, to the customer experience.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Mr. Mike Spatafor. Thank you to Mike for being on the show. If you did enjoy this episode and want to become more ingrained with Wisco Weekly, then do consider subscribing if this is your first time here. And if you're a longtime subscriber, then also consider joining my email list. I am sending more communication out, and I certainly want to make sure it is as valuable as possible to you and that it doesn't get entered into your spam folder. So if you want to know some more other brilliant minds and critical thinkers in this automotive and mobility space and get more access to this type of exclusive content, then please do sign up on the website, wiscoweeklypod.com, and I will send you out some goodies every time I get something. So, also, I am building out the YouTube channel, and this is where I will want to share with you the stories of how people and goods move in this mobility revolution. So be sure you search out Wisco Weekly on YouTube and subscribe there. So thanks for tuning into this episode. We will see you next week.